from the sessions on the Sermon on the Mount. And I put across the board the title, Does It Help to Turn the Other Cheek? Dolores, my wife, has told me that that's probably not a very good idea because it brings images to her mind that don't help very much. But I put that there simply to indicate that it is worthwhile to think about what we're going to do with some of these sentences in the Sermon on the Mount, how we're going to handle them, how we're going to respond to them. And so I tried the first time that we were together on Monday to talk about some issues and some options, issues arising from simply looking at the text itself. That is, that if we notice that a lot of that material, about half of it, is also in Luke, sometimes called the Sermon on the Plain, we have to begin to worry about the fact that Matthew has a hand in putting together that material in the particular shape in which we find it, that the words of Jesus come to us filtered through Matthew. And there's nothing we can do about that except to accept it as the way God chose to give it to us, and to take Matthew into consideration as we read the words of Jesus in his gospel. And we notice things like the fivefold structure of Matthew's gospel, that five times there are long discourses followed by the phrase, and when Jesus had finished these sayings. And there is some connection there between the five books of Moses and Matthew's presentation of the life and teaching of Jesus. Things like in 5:1, Jesus speaks to his disciples, but in 7:28, the crowds are astonished. Raise the issue of whether these words are intended as some kind of blueprint for all of society, for the crowds, or whether they are intended specifically as a way of life for disciples, and it makes a lot of difference which one of those things one chooses. So we looked at some basic options for the interpretation of the Sermon on the Mount, the first of which I call the absolutist position, which says, it says to turn the other cheek, and that means you do it, period. There's nothing more to be said. It's not a question of understanding. It's simply a matter of doing it. But we looked at a lot of other ways of reading the Sermon on the Mount, which say, yes, that's true, however. And some ways are built into the text itself. There are exceptions. There are ways in which people say, yes, but Jesus was exaggerating to make a point. He was laying out general principles rather than specific directions. We looked at the classic Roman Catholic position of the precepts on the councils, Luther's Doctrine of the Two Kingdoms, etc. Yesterday, we zeroed in on one verse, 5:17, where Jesus says, think not that I came to abolish the law and the prophets. I came not to abolish them, but to fulfill them. We talked about that one verse. We've talked about the law. And I tried to argue a position there that we have tended, most of us, to think of the law only negatively, to think that there are only two options, either legalism or lawlessness. And I tried to say that maybe we have to rethink that whole business of the Christian and the law in terms of Jesus as the fulfillment of the law, that is, the one to whom the law points, and in whom the law is fulfilled, in which case the law becomes God's gracious gift of non-chaotic existence. And maybe as Christians we ought to pay more attention to the law than particularly we Lutherans are inclined to do. I'd like to look with you a little bit at chapter 6 today, and I'd like to quit with maybe a good half hour, or possibly even more, for conversation, since the time for talk has been relatively slight, and this is the last time we'll be together on this text. There are patterns in the Sermon on the Mount, as there are in most of biblical literature. So that in chapter 5, we had 6 of those antitheses. You have heard it said, but I say to you. And it's nicely structured. We come to chapter 6, and there are 3 comments of Jesus, one about giving alms, one about praying, and one about fasting. And wedged in there, in the saying about praying, is of course the Lord's Prayer. And these 3 sayings are very stylized, and each one of them ends up by saying, when you give alms, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your alms may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. And the one on prayer says, truly I say to you, they have their reward, but when you pray, go into your room and shut the door, and pray to your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. And the one on fasting is exactly the same structure, but when you fast, anoint your head, wash your face, that your fasting may not be seen by men, but by your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. So we have alms and praying and fasting, and each one is very stylized and structured in exactly the same way. Now, does any one of you have a King James Version? Okay, would you, you noticed when I read, I think, that at the end of each one of those, the King James Version has an addition. And do you want to read verse 4 of chapter 6?
That thine alms may be in secret, and thy Father which seeth in secret himself shall reward thee openly.
Okay. And that's also true. Maybe you ought to read that, verse 6.
But thou, when thou prayest, enter into thy closet, and when thou hast shut thy door, pray to thy Father which is in secret, and thy Father which seeth in secret shall reward thee openly.
Okay, and verse 18.
That thou appear not unto the men to fast, but unto thy Father which is in secret, and thy Father which seeth in secret shall reward thee openly.
Okay. In the Revised Standard Version, and I'm quite sure, New English Bible, Jerusalem Bible, Good News for Modern Man, contemporary edition of the New Testament, the thing stops with the word, will reward you, period. King James Version says, your alms may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. You pray in secret, and your Father who hears in secret will reward you openly. You fast in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. In the King James Version, in each case, you have the addition of the word openly or in the open. Anybody care to venture an opinion about why that is, how that happens? Why do we have an additional word there, openly, that does not occur in any of these other editions? At least I'd be very surprised. I haven't checked all the editions, but any of you who have any more contemporary edition, I'd be very, very surprised. In fact, I'd be astonished if it were there. Anybody care to venture an opinion on that?
There.
Do you want to elaborate?
Well, someone transcribed something at that moment. He decided to leave a message for himself to do something. But it's open and open.
Okay.
Okay.
That's correct. It has nothing to do with translation. It has to do with the text that's translated. And the King James Version is built on a 13th century manuscript, and by that time in the transmission of the text, the word openly is there. And so it occurs in the King James Version. But when you go back behind the 13th century, You get back to the 5th century, to the 4th century, to the 3rd century, on which RSV, NEB, and all other contemporary versions are based. The word openly is not there. It just ain't there in any of the early manuscript tradition. Now, do you care to work with that a while? Why would anybody add that? Why isn't it good enough as it is? See? There's almost no question. I would say there is no question about it. The word openly is not in the original text. But it was added. Why?
And they didn't want to wait for the reward.
You want your goodies right now. Right there. Huh? Okay. So that raises a whole problem in the living of the Christian life and in the understanding of the Sermon on the Mount, namely the juxtaposition or the relationship between visibility and hiddenness. And the people who added that word openly, that's actually very strange, because if you were going to add something just by the rhythm, the movement of the sentence, you'd think you'd add, "will reward you in secret." So your alms may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you in secret. You'd think, you know, if you were adding it just by the rhythm of the passage, by the drive of the words, that that's what you'd add. But they didn't add that. They added "in the open." Now, it seems to me that that is a persistent and perennial problem in the church, that we are not willing to live with the anguish, with the tension, with the ambiguity of visibility and hiddenness. We want everything visible. We want them to know we are Christians by our love, period. Huh? Just like that. The Protestant ethic is a word that is used to describe an attitude about Christianity which developed early in the history of this country, but which is very much with us, that says that if we do our alms, if we do our praying, if we do our fasting in secret, God will reward us in the open. Okay. So then you say, who is a Christian and who is not a Christian? Well, it's like this. If we pray, if we give alms, if we fast, if we do the right things, God will reward us, and he'll reward us openly. Therefore, if I'm prosperous, that means God has rewarded me because I'm such a good Christian. And so you can just look around and see who the Christians are, because God prospers those who are faithful. And obviously, if someone is not prospering, that means that that person has not prayed, has not given alms, has not fasted, has not done the right things. Huh? So your Christianity is very, very visible, because God rewards you in the open. Now, it's ticklish, because as you go through the Sermon on the Mount, there are statements that are indicative of the visibility, and there are statements that are indicative of the hiddenness, and so you have to somehow or another bounce back and forth from one to the other. Let's just go through some of these verses. Chapter 5, verses 11 and 12. "Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you." Well, one might think, gee, it's very visible. If we're being persecuted, that means we're on the team. You run into people like that, that's a sure proof. That's an absolute sure proof that one belongs to God if one is being persecuted. It's totally visible. Huh? But then you have the words, evil against you falsely, then you have to worry a little bit. It isn't just being persecuted. It's being persecuted falsely on my account. So there is some hiddenness packed into that visibility, and it is not necessarily the case that if one is persecuted, one is automatically blessed by God. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. Oh! Chapter 5, verse 16. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. That seems, that's an unambiguous visibility statement. I mean, you are the light of the world, and you put it on a lamp, on a stand, and you let your light shine before men, and they look at you and they say, wow, God must really be something. It's a kind of an unambiguous visibility statement. What about chapter 6 in the lilies of the field and the birds of the air business? Verse 33, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. That's kind of hidden, is it not? The righteousness of God. You can't necessarily see that. And all these things, neuter plural, will be yours as well. Well, that sounds like it's easy. You just run around and see someone who has all these things. And if a person has all these things, automatically that means, well, they've sought the kingdom first. If you don't have all these things, obviously you haven't sought the kingdom. Because if you seek the kingdom, you will have all these things. And it's not talking about spiritual things. It's talking about food and clothing and that kind of stuff in that context. So that sounds like sheer visibility. Chapter 7, verse 1, judge not. That sounds like hiddenness. We ought not to judge one another because we can't really see the heart. We don't really know what's going on inside, so we ought not to be judged. That you be not judged. Oh. Maybe I can tell whether I'm judging or not by whether or not I'm judged. If I don't sense that I'm judged, that means I'm okay, I haven't been judging. Or does it mean that? For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged, and the measure you give will be the measure you get. Oh. I'm getting along great. I mean, I'm not aware that I am meted out any great judgment. I'm much blessed. Therefore, I must be a pretty good guy not going around judging, because if I were a bad guy going around judging everybody, then I would be judged and measure for measure. That sounds like visibility again. Verse 7, chapter 7, ask and it'll be given you. You don't have it? You haven't asked for it. You're not a good enough Christian. You don't believe God's promises. Because if you were a good Christian, if you believed God's promises, you'd have it. Huh? Knock and it'll be opened unto you. Seek and you will find. Well, it's just, that's pure visibility. And if you don't have it, that means you're a bad Christian. Verse 15 of chapter 7, beware of false prophets. That's a kind of a hiddenness thing again. False prophets. All prophets aren't true prophets. There can be false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. Oh, have to be careful about that prophecy. It's not so obvious. Some of them are in sheep's clothing. I have to worry a little bit about that. Is that a true prophet or not? Nah. Verse 16, you'll know them by their fruits. Big favorite Bible verse of all kinds of people. You'll know them by their fruits. Look at the fruits. You go back and you see whether or not that person's a Christian. Only a good tree, goes on to say, can give good fruit. And a bad tree cannot give good fruit. So you can define Christianity not in terms of faith, but in terms of fruit. There are a lot of people who do that, who define Christianity moralistically or behaviorally. So you go around the world and you pick out all the good guys and you say, they're all Christians. You'll know them by their fruits. They're doing all these lovely things. Obviously, they're Christians. I'm not a Christian, I'm a Buddhist. Shut up, you're a Christian. You're too good a guy to be a Buddhist. You're doing all these good things. Obviously, you're a Christian. You'll know them by their fruits. Sheer visibility. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom. Hiddenness again. But he who does the will of my Father who's in heaven. Oh, visibility. You can go through the Sermon on the Mount and you have over and over again the juxtaposition, the interlacing, the alterations of visibility and of hiddenness, and there is no way to grab onto what the Sermon on the Mount is saying, what the whole Bible is saying, unless one grabs onto both of those at the same time. And that has a lot to do with the entire Christian message. Cuts across the whole board of Christian affirmation. Jesus himself is not invisible. He walked and he talked and he ate fish and he went into the temple. I mean, the Word became flesh. That was not invisible. Visible is all get out. But hidden at the same time, some people could say, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God, and other people said, you're doing this by Beelzebub, or you're one more cheap street magician. Not invisible, very visible, but hidden, not provable, not demonstrable. Jesus did those miracles, and they were public acts. They were done on the street corner. And some people said, wow, the Son of God. And other people said, ho, ho, hum, another cheap magician. The sacrament, the bread and the wine are not invisible. That's grape and grain, and you can feel it and smell it and touch it and taste it. That's real stuff. But also hidden, the body and the blood of Jesus Christ. And if you talk about that as invisible, you've missed it, because it's visible. But if you talk about it as somehow demonstrable, as provable, then you've also missed it. The church is not invisible. The church is people. I mean, here we are. I can see you. You can see me. The church is never invisible. The church is visible. But it's also hidden, and it's perfectly possible for you or me or someone walking in the door to not see the body of Christ sitting here. God, the God of the Bible, is not invisible. I realize we use that word. It occurs once in a while in the Bible, and we sing it in the hymns. But the big thing about the God of the Bible is not that he's invisible. The big thing about the God of the Bible is that he has revealed himself. He has shown himself. He has made himself known. He has become enfleshed in Jesus of Nazareth. He brought his people out of Egypt, the pillar of fire, the pillar of smoke. God has made himself known to us. He's not the unknown. He's the known. He's not the invisible. He has allowed himself to be seen by us. But he is also hidden at the same time. If he were only visible and not hidden, then he'd be provable. If he were only hidden and not visible, then faith would be totally unattached to any kind of empirical data at all. So that faith is not believing what I can't know. I rather suspect, if we sent a paper around the room and had everybody write a definition of faith, that we'd come up with a large percentage of definitions that would be very close to faith is believing what I can't know. You know some things, but some things you can't know, so you believe those things. Faith is not like that. Faith is taking data. Faith is taking words and sentences from the scriptures, events, the Exodus, the birth of Jesus, the life of Jesus, the cross, public events, Quirinius, governor of Syria, Pontius Pilate. Faith is taking data and arranging it in certain configurations which shout out, Jesus is Lord. So that faith is not invisible, but neither is it demonstrable. It's visible and it's hidden at the same time. Okay? That has an awful lot to do with discipleship, with the Christian life. It means that you and I cannot expect that our living of the Christian life, our letting the light shine or whatever, we cannot expect that our living of the Christian life is going to be any less hidden than was Jesus' own life. If Jesus' own life was such that people could say, you're a cheap magician, or thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God, that's also going to be true of our lives. And people are going to be able to look at us, and there, some will see those good works and glorify God who is in heaven, and others would say, you've got a good set of genes, you were toilet trained at the right time, you're a nice person. You're a good person. And we've got to live with that ambiguity, and that's why ultimately there is no authentic witness to Jesus Christ apart from the naming of the name, the verbalization of the good news. Somebody, somewhere, has to say the name and tell the story. There is no way that the church can last for very long if we're going to rely on people to look at us and say, Jay, you're gorgeous. I want to be like you. It doesn't work that way. At least it doesn't work that way in any simple, direct manner. Okay? So that's some stuff on the Sermon on the Mount. And we've tried to talk about some issues and some options. We've tried to talk about Christians and the law, tried to talk about hiddenness and visibility, and we have a half hour, and I hope we can have some conversation. You bring up anything you want or say anything you want about the Sermon on the Mount. Yeah.
Could the use of the word, or the addition of the word openly, be interpreted in this manner, that our private and personal worship, as well as our private and personal good deeds, are done for private and personal reasons, but that that also will ultimately reveal God to others, to those around us. Could it be a simplistic way of saying revelation rather than openly or for show or for, that's maybe not put very well, but I was trying to see, you know, to put a positive approach to that, and immediately when you see that word openly, then you think, oh yes, openly, yes, we should be then rewarded openly so as to be self-glorified.
Yeah.
But if you can look at it as being, the motivation being right, and the act being really secret,
uh-huh,
then it will be visible. It will ultimately be visible to the to anyone around us. And in that way, we are not glorified, but hopefully God is.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to say. As you say it will be visible, I want to say yes and also hidden, but maybe it ought also to be said that that there has to be, on the part of the Christian at least, a bias on the side of visibility. That there has to be, on the part of the Christian at least, a bias on the side of visibility. That is, it's disaster if we eliminate hiddenness, but maybe there has to be a bias on the side of visibility. That is, if we talk about the individual Christian, then we have to allow for the possibility of a person of strong commitment and faith living in total disaster. Job's friends come to him and say, okay, what have you done wrong now? Because, I mean, your roof has caved in and your cattle are dead, and, I mean, you've got all those boils. You've obviously done something wrong. Job says, no, it isn't like that. So Job's friends make the mistake of a visibility connection without hiddenness. Or the Pharisees come to Jesus and say, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he should be born blind? The person is in a bad situation. Obviously, he or his parents have sinned. So they, too, have a direct line on visibility. And that has to be squashed by affirming the hiddenness. The other side of that is that you're suggesting that if we didn't believe that somehow or another in the long haul the people of God corporately are doing good for one another and for the earth, what in the world are we doing being Christians? So that when I press myself about why I'm a Christian, I can say and mean and believe all of the personal things about freedom and release and assurance and all of that, but I know that the psychological data are reproducible in other than Christian contexts. And so it's very possible for an unbeliever or a Buddhist or whatever to say, I feel so free, I feel so wonderful, a new life has, you know, say all of those things. So I've got to construct an argument on the basis of the long movement of God's people through history. And I believe that it is the case that that soil, which is fertilized with the gospel of Jesus Christ, is soil which is healthier for human beings than soil which is not fertilized by the gospel. And I would like to point to things like education and care of the body and political structures and all kinds of things. But even that is not unhidden, because my opponent comes and says, what about the Inquisition and the Crusades and all that? I say, okay, okay, true, it's ambiguous, but my bias has to be on the side of visibility. I would agree with that, and maybe there is a way in which that openly can be interpreted positively in that way. That's a kind of a long...
I don't know that it's a necessary point, but
yeah. Yeah. Let's go over here. Did you have your hand up, or Dick?
Do I hear you saying that the faith is looking at the data and saying, I believe this, out of the data? You
sure.
All the stuff from history and what you know about the behavior of people in various civilizations, and you look at it and you say, I believe that the hand of God is at work here for the good of his people. Or whatever it is that you believe, it is your way of putting together all the data.
I would, yes, I would like to say the church's way, in which I involve myself. And I should also certainly say that there are different ways of configurating that data. Certainly, there are people who do not think historically. There are people who think very much in terms of personal experience, but that's also data. And that the definition of faith as believing what you can't know is absolute disaster, because it makes of God the unknown rather than the known. And it makes of God someone who is detached from empirical life, rather than the God of the Bible, who makes himself known specifically through tastable, touchable, smellable, seeable phenomena. In the first epistle of John, John says, that which we have seen with our eyes and touched with our hands concerning the word of life, we proclaim to you. It's not a wisp of smoke that we're talking about. It's a God who has made himself known in the history of Israel, in the flesh of Jesus of Nazareth, in the history of the church. Yeah, the body of Christ. Yeah.
I just say that you also, I think, have to say it's not empirical. And at least in Lutheran schools, many parochial schools, I think the mistake is made that we tend to make it seem empirical. And then when you're confronted with a scientist or someone who might argue from an empirical viewpoint, then you all of a sudden don't know what, you may not know how to respond.
I would distinguish between empirical and demonstrable. I would say you cannot make the Christian faith demonstrable, that is, provable. But then I would want to say neither can you prove anything else. There is nothing that is totally provable. Science is built up of hypotheses on the basis of induction from data. And you see whether the thing flies or not. You try to repeat the experiment, and there is a high degree of probability and all of that. But it is a degree of probability. And faith is not all that different structurally from science. It's not provable, but it certainly is empirical. Empirical means sense data. Stuff that can be handled, seen, measured, touched, tasted. And I think there's a great deal at stake, and we dare not, I think, talk about faith in a non-empirical way. Faith talks about words and sentences and semicolons and manuscripts and Jesus and the church and people and bread and wine and all kinds of handleable material. And it selects and it configurates and it says, Jesus is Lord of all. Do you want to come back on that?
I just had some discussions with colleagues who speak in an empirical way, and they agree that in the end, as you said, that their viewpoint, they can't prove it to me, and I can't prove it to them in an empirical manner. We usually end with a kind of standoff.
Yeah, but that's disaster, isn't it? Because then Christian faith becomes a matter of taste. I like apples, you like oranges, that's where we are, bye-bye. Huh? That's disaster. If the Christian faith cannot stand up to observation and to reflection and to persuasion and argument, that doesn't mean everybody's going to be convinced, but if it cannot stand up, then is it true? Hmm? Is it worth
it?
That's all right. No,
then it is a standoff if he doesn't accept your...
Okay, I suppose it makes some difference how quickly one says that. Huh? But it seems to me that in many conversations, the standoff comes very quickly and says, after all, we're talking about non-empirical things, we're talking about opinions, and I'm a Christian and you're not, and I like apples, you like oranges, that's the end of the matter. Hmm? That's disaster if we turn Christian faith into taste. Dale?
You know, what if it is provable if we apply the right kind of test? That's the thing that involves self and
yes.
We discover in time that if you're not going to test how much something weighs by examining its light emissions, if you're going to use a test appropriate to what you're trying to measure, to measure the presence of faith, you will not use the same instrument that you will use to measure the weight of your apples or the coloring. Or use it to divide another test.
Okay, I would buy that if we qualify the word demonstrable to include an element of personal commitment, then I would say, yes, the Christian faith is as demonstrable as are lots of other things. Nothing is totally demonstrable. Well, the Christian faith is certainly not totally undemonstrable. It's on a spectrum with everything else that we work with in the world. Yeah. Christianity is not only nice or helpful, Christians believe it's true. It is the case about trees and rocks and birds and bees and the sun and the moon and the stars and guilt and forgiveness and everything else, because Jesus is Lord of all, the one in whom and through whom and for whom all things were made. It's really true. Yeah.
The derivation of truth from data always involves some sort of a leap of faith, whether you're a scientist or a Christian. You assemble data on a subject and you make a great leap to some assumption in a way the data can be assembled.
Right.
And the data do not prove anything except in the light of your assumption. And then I hear you saying that faith is my set of assumptions on which I choose to assemble the data of my life and my experience and the data that the world gives me. And so I am able to see it all this way, and it does hang together.
And I do commit myself.
Right. I commit myself to my theories, if I'm a scientist, to my faith, if I'm a Christian, and in this I will stand in my ability to make sense out of the whole world in the light of my interpretation of the data.
All of this has a great deal to do with hiddenness and visibility. It may be that some of you are lost a little bit in the theological, philosophical conversation here. We can come back anytime you want to the living of the Christian life, to the words of the Sermon on the Mount. Jean, and then we have someone over here.
I've just been aware within the past year of fasting in our contemporary world. And I'm wondering if what you're opinion of fasting and function is.
well, I think we have to, you know, collect some comments on that. I've been in situations where people fast. I've heard arguments about that, you know, quite apart from the dieting thing, that it is just a plain healthy thing to do. I think that is, that's not uninteresting to me. I think that the, a lot of the stuff, and that's part of that natural law theory we were talking about, a lot of stuff that we ought to do in the Bible is good for us to do. And so I guess I'm interested in that. I have not yet myself come to the point where I have figured that fasting was something that was particularly significant for me to do, because it seems to me that I'm so capable of playing games with that. You know, I have fasted sometimes when I've been in groups that have done, but I stoke up before and I stoke up after, and I don't know what it all means, really. Anybody want to comment on that? Some of you may have some opinions or experiences or feelings about that. We'll put you on the back burner, if that's okay, and talk fasting for a minute.
What did it mean to Jesus and the people he said that to?
I think that, yeah, maybe someone knows. I don't know much about that either. I should know something about that, but I don't. I think that fasting was not an uncommon religious phenomenon. And it's not an uncommon religious phenomenon today either. There are, in the same way that there are non-Christians who speak in tongues, there are non-Christians who have rite de passage rituals, there are also non-Christians who fast, huh? So it's a kind of a religious thing that is and can't be incorporated into Christian faith. I don't know, really. There's a lot of talk about fasting in the New Testament, certainly. And there's a lot of critical talk about those who fast inappropriately.
There's this one miracle where the epileptic boy was brought before Jesus by the disciples, and he cast out the demon. The disciples said, why can't we do this? And he said, this only comes by prayer and fasting.
Yeah.
Is that to suggest what?
No, I don't think that's to suggest.
I mean, is that to suggest?
Oh.
I mean, is that, does that mean fasting is somehow some kind of a qualitative thing of the faith, or what?
It would have to mean, if we buy the general line of what I've been saying here, that prayer and fasting in that case may be part of the whole picture of a committed community in which God is active. I think it would be grossly misinterpreted if one thought of that sentence as meaning that if I pray, oh Lord, and skip a meal, that I can cure any epileptic that comes around. Huh? That would be a misreading of the text. But that's not to say that the practice of the church has nothing to do with whether and what God does in the life of that community. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of part of the mix. Gene?
I was wondering what you, what I thought you had about it. What was told to me was that by fasting, it's a very practical method of by keeping yourself away from something that you take as a routine thing, like picking up a snack. By keeping yourself from doing this, you bring your mind back to why you're doing it. Prayer and meditation and so on. Out of your busy daily routine, you not only just keep going and forget.
Now, I happen almost never to eat the new meal here. And I find that in my schedule of things, that's a good thing for me to do. And I do, as a matter of fact, wind up during that time sometimes praying and meditating. I guess it would never occur to me to tell myself I'm fasting now. I don't know why that is. Maybe that's odd. Maybe I ought to say, yes, I fast every noon. Maybe. I don't know. I guess that's just an element that I've not worked with very much or reflected on very much.
I think that fasting is different from not eating. I mean, I'm not quite sure what it meant as a religious form at that time. But I mean, when people talk now about fasting, I mean, fasting at a time when you wouldn't have eaten, I mean, isn't that hard to do?
Yeah.
I mean, it's at the time you pass a meal time that you feel hungry. I mean, that sense of hunger, I mean, goes away. I mean, after the meal would have been over, and then, I mean, that sort of cycle lasts for a couple of days. I mean, if one fasts. And so I'm not quite sure. I mean, I fasted, but if it really hasn't had any religious significance for me. I mean, I could say that it heightened my sensitivity, but.
Okay, we can come back to that or not. Let's pick up your comment.
Oh, I think I'm willing to debate the hypothesis.
Yes, I
mean, I can. Provable part of faith is part of it. There's a lot of children that don't know the difference between a virgin and a hybrid. You've got Abraham that didn't have a road back to Canaan.
Uh-huh.
You've got the sharecropper that couldn't leave.
Uh-huh.
And yet they've got lives that are examples of faith. So don't tip the thing.
Okay, that's another very important thing to say, and it does fit in with this hiddenness visibility business. The major problem with the so-called Protestant ethic is that it wipes out the grace of God, that it makes Christianity a matter of moral behavior rather than of God's gracious gift. And so if we only talk about faith, as we were talking about it here, gathering data and arranging it and all of this, then we run the risk of turning faith into a purely intellectual phenomenon, and we wipe out those people who are either incapable of, because of being 3 months old or something, or uninterested in that kind of reflection. So it does have to be said that there is a, I suppose, paradox or dialectic going there too, that on the one hand, faith is a gift of God, and when someone says, why do you believe in Jesus? One appropriate answer is, because God has chosen me. I haven't chosen him. But if that's all we say, then it's over with evangelism, because then the other person can simply say, oh, well, I guess he hasn't chosen me. Bye-bye. Huh? So we have to also give a reason for the faith that is in us, and so we have to somehow or another work both with the divine initiative and the human response, and the human response is not only moral or emotional, but it's also intellectual, because we are total beings, and our mind is part of who we are, and so reflection is not inappropriate to faith. Maybe we ought to, in the last few minutes here, simply state the question again: does it help to turn the other cheek? Even that question may be thought, I suppose, to be inappropriate, because we ought to simply ask, what does Jesus want us to do? And we ought to do it whether it helps or not. If it's right, it's right. If it's wrong, it's wrong. And we ought not to ask about the effect. I phrase the question this way, I guess, because I think that the effect is something that Christians ought to take into consideration, because God is doing something with his world. He's doing something through us. He does have a goal. He does have a purpose with his world. And we do have to worry not just about naked rightness and wrongness, but we have to worry about what are the short-term and long-term effects of our actions. And I would hope that one of the things that might have come out of that abortion conversation last night was that we do have to worry about long-range, long-term effects of our decisions and our actions. So does it help to turn the other cheek? I think is not an inappropriate question to ask, and it seems to me that it is a mistake to absolutize and to universalize that statement and these other statements of Jesus. I do think that they are the words of Jesus, that they are helpful, that they are valid, but that they also have to be placed in context and they have to be addressed to specific situations. And I would have to say, does it help to turn the other cheek? Sometimes, but not necessarily. There may be times when that word of Jesus has to be put up against some other word, and when we may decide that turning the other cheek is not.
Might it help
allegiance
to turn the other cheek just as much as it might help not to turn the other cheek? So if you weigh the benefits one against another and say, well, if turning the other cheek is not the solution, then is a violent conflict or initiation of a really dramatic confrontation the solution?
And when that's discussed, then the effects have to come into play. And so those who are pacifists and those who are not pacifists, for instance, have to argue with one another, it seems to me, not just on the basis of mouthing that one verse, but on the basis of trying to put together the effect of one action and the effect of the other. I don't myself happen to be a pacifist. And I think there are times when violent resistance to evil is appropriate. I think those are rare situations.
That's what Evan said, though. I myself feel that there's never a time when you could initiate something forceful or violent. Because I guess I hear from a situation where it would be helpful.
Well, that depends on what you mean by violent. I don't know. I think that there are different levels of pacifist thought. And one says, well, don't do anything violent. Well, that means don't ever hit anybody. But anytime one does anything, one insight of Gandhi's was there's no such thing as nonviolence. Because if the silk workers refuse to go into the plant non-violently, they're being violent. They are forcing the owner of the silk factory to do something different. And that's every bit as much force as if they would have hit the owner of the silk factory. I mean, you might distinguish between different kinds of violence and which are better, but I would claim that if you're going to start distinguishing kinds of violence, that hitting somebody is not always the worst kind of violence, particularly, let's say, in relation to children. I think it's a much crueler form of violence to tell a child, well, I don't love you, than it is to swat him and still say you love him. I mean, just in bringing up children.
If I could just jump onto that, I would say that it may be a worse form of violence to say to a child by deed and word, it's just fine whatever you want to do.
Huh?
That may be a worse form of violence than whacking the kid one and teaching him that there are forms of behavior that are inappropriate and that are going to hurt himself and other people.
Mm-hmm.
So that does get to be, I think, a very complex and tricky question. It's 10:15, and we'll close, and thanks very much.